Hi, I'm Hannah Brown, and welcome to Better Tomorrow. My absolute favorite thing to do is have a heart-to-heart talk with my new friends and my best friends, where we sit down and talk about all the things like relationships and love, faith, and self-care. And of course, the little things as well, like the struggle to figure out what to eat tonight. All in all, I really want to ask, how am I better today than yesterday? And bring artists, entrepreneurs, and friends along on the journey. So join me on the journey, will you? I am so excited for our guest today because when I started Better Tomorrow, I put together like a list of people that I wanted to have on the show. And this guest was one on like my very first list because her book was a book that like resonated with me so much at like the perfect time in my life. So we have Tara Schuster on the podcast today, who wrote one of my favorite books, Buy Yourself the Effing Lilies. And so I'm so excited that we're finally getting to get this together, have this conversation. So thank you so much, Tara, for being here.
Oh my goodness. Thank you. I'm thrilled. This is a long time in the making.
I know. We've messaged back and forth trying to get this like scheduled because, like I said, I loved your first book. Again, thank you for being here. And I can't wait to talk about just your life. Also your newest book, Glow in the Effing Dark. So this is like a dream for me to talk to you.
Me too.
So you were an executive at Comedy Central working in television. So how did you even start writing self-help books?
Yeah, it is not an obvious path to self-help books. I was firmly at Comedy Central. I worked there fully 12 years. It was the first job I had out of college. I was an intern at The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. So, you know, writing self-help books was definitely not my intended career path at all. What happened was I wrote my first book, Buy Yourself the Effing Lilies, out of necessity. You know, it wasn't to be a self-help author. It was to save my life. As you know, I grew up in a neglectful, psychologically abusive household where, as I cheerily put it in the book, things came to die, you know, like the pets, all the plants. Yeah. It was a mess wreck disaster. I don't blame my parents now. What I understand is they did not know how to take care of kids. Mm-hmm. And I don't even think they had the self-awareness to know they could learn, you know? How they treated me wasn't personally. I don't think if I had said to them, hey, do you want to neglect and psychologically abuse me? That they'd be like, yeah, that sounds like a good idea.
That's the plan. Am I not doing a good job? It's like, yeah, you're doing perfect. Just wanted to make sure you're going for. But if it is, you're killing totally. It.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I just don't think they knew any better. And unfortunately, the consequence that had on me was I exited my childhood thinking two things. One, I was worthless because if the adults in your life don't take care of you, that's the message. I'm not worth taking care of. And then two, that something was inherently bad about me because, you know, why else? Why would these adults be ignoring me if there was something bad? And you know, this left me with severe anxiety and depression, but also a need for external validation because I wasn't getting attention from my parents. So, you know, it made me like teacher's pet times 10. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I'm going to have lunch with my teachers and go to their houses for dinners. And like my whole life was tied up in school, which drove this, you know, all A's, all APs in high school, got to an Ivy League college. Ivy League college is going to save my life. Spoiler alert, it didn't. You know, get this internship at The Daily Show, hustle, 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 go, 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 go. So I really quickly climbed up the corporate ladder at Comedy Central and became one of the youngest executives ever, where I ran shows like Key and Peele. If you've seen Key and Peele, I ran that show on behalf of the network. So it was crazy amazing. You know, I did really, really well. But internally, I was the girl uncontrollably sobbing on the subway next to you.
Yeah.
You know, you've seen that girl.
I've seen that girl. I've been that girl.
Yeah,
we've all been that girl. But just like walking down the street, just being
yes,
like,
yes.
What's wrong with me?
Usually yeah. holding too many bags for some reason. Just yes. too many tote bags. I don't know what's in these bags. And oh my
gosh, that is me all the time.
Right. Right.
I don't know. I've got to probably work on that. But it's like, why do I have a Mary Poppins bag at all times? I don't have any children.
I don't know. I'm not care.
I don't know.
No. I'm like, I don't yeah. need any of this stuff. And so you're just like literally weighing me down. You know, yeah. it's a metaphor and it's real life. It's weighing me down. And so I might have kept going this way until I hit a rock bottom on my 25th birthday when I drunk dialed my therapist threatening to hurt myself. And it was that next morning where I realized, okay, I'm good at work. I'm bad at life. If you know, like that's real life right now for me. And if I don't save my life, I'm not going to have much more of a life to live. And so out of necessity, out of utter urgency, I don't want to die. I want more life. I decided I need to become my own parent. How do you do that? You know, I'm like, I need to reparent myself. This was 10 years ago. So this was before anyone was using the term reparent. So mm-hmm. I was like on my own. You know, I obviously couldn't turn to my parents.
Had your therapist said those words to you? Like, how did you even know, like, okay, this is what I need to do?
It probably came up in some book or something. Like I heard the term. Like for sure it was somewhere in my subconscious, but no one had ever said to me, oh, you know what you could do? You could become your own parent. Like you could fill in all these holes. And so that morning, you know, I also, and I really try to stress this, did not have any wise mentors. That there were no adults. Yes. For anybody who doesn't have a mentor, nor did I at all. And so I just decided I'm going to treat this like a work project. I'm going to start a Google Doc. I'm going to put in all the questions I have, you know, what are values, what are principles, what are vegetables, like genuinely, what are they, which one should I be eating? And I did that, kept this Google Doc for 5 years. I was reading memoirs like those were mentors. I'm having these embarrassing journaling sessions pretending Nora Ephron is my mom. Like after reading her book. Yeah. I mean, I was desperate. I would do anything. I'd ask any adult what they thought I should do differently. I listened to podcasts, read philosophy, anything I could do. I did it for 5 years. At the end of 5 years, I had a 600-page Google Doc.
Wow.
And that is when I thought, oh, guess what? I just accidentally wrote a book on how to help yourself. So that's how it came to be.
So it wasn't like when you sat down and started to like be like, okay, I need to like fix my life. Because I think of that because of someone who could like get it. External validation has been like a propeller in my life as well. There was no thought of like, okay, I'm going to fix my life. But if I can do that and somehow like work this through and maybe it can become a big book.
Yeah.
Okay. That'll be worth it because that will maybe be well. And people will be like, oh, she wrote a book. Like that was not the thought. This was truly like for yourself.
No, at that point I had lost the ability to dream. I didn't think it was possible for me to do anything meaningful with my life. Life felt like a series of crises to endure, like as if I were over hot lava and I was just hopscotching.
Yeah.
That was life. I had no dreams of any sort.
So even in your work, you felt that way too at that time? Like it was just like, I'm going to work to survive, but I'm not thinking, oh, I can become an executive at this point.
No.
Like that was.
No, I mean, and on top of everything, there was no job I wanted in front of me, you know, which was a sign that like, it was an amazing day job. I had the best time ever. I met amazing people. But that also is probably a sign that it wasn't exactly the right job. But I was so tunnel vision with you need to succeed. You need to succeed. You need more promotions, more money, more of a safety net, you know, that I was really myopic. I it was just keep on going, keep on achieving, woman.
Yeah, I definitely can relate to that. I want to kind of go back to your childhood being, I'll say it nicely, like less than ideal.
Yeah.
But you kind of described more like what it was like growing up. But what I've been learning a lot in therapy is like these ways that we learn to cope really served us at the time. And then as we get older, they start to not really serve us. But what were some coping mechanisms and protection that really served you when you were younger in that childhood experience that were great then, but that you realized as you got to be an adult that you didn't need those anymore?
Yeah, that's such a good point. And I think it's everyone needs to know this, that it's not like these parts of you inside want to hurt you.
Yeah.
They're actually all trying to help you. And that's so beautiful. And thank you, little five-year-old mind, for coming up with these coping mechanisms. Yes. But I wouldn't trust you to run my life today. So like, please know.
Like, yeah.
Adult me is now going to come online. So definitely external validation was the number one. Just keep hustling. Don't think. Don't feel. Just overwhelm yourself. Muscle your way through everything. No sense of ease. Never being gentle with myself. Endless self-criticism. Mm-hmm. Just in my mind, it was just a diss track of the top 40 golden oldie, these are all the things that are wrong with me.
Yeah.
And thinking back, it was really painful to live a life thinking, I mean, truly, the only things I could hear in my mind were, nobody cares about you, you're unlovable, you're ugly, you're too old, so if you haven't succeeded by now, you never will. I was 25 at that time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? To anyone who feels that today, you know, we can all feel that at different times, and it's always just fear. It's never real, just fear. And it was painful. Like it would manifest as a knot in my heart. And so I'd just constantly be like kneading my heart and like armpit as I'm walking down the street, because I'm just listening to this horrible soundtrack to my life. Self-criticism, which I understand now, was trying to push me. You know, it was trying to get me out of the house. Its positive intent was, okay, we need to be better. We need to protect ourselves. We need to survive. But as an adult, I mean, self-criticism is probably the thing I've worked the most on, because not only is it painful, it is really, really bad for your mental health. One of the worst things. And very few of us stop and pay attention to it. So I think that was one of the primary coping mechanisms I use that just didn't serve me as I got older.
Yeah, I definitely relate to that. I think a lot of people can. And I also want to say, like, you could like read your story and be like, oh gosh, like I said, less than ideal. But even I've talked about my story. Like, I know that my parents were like sometimes there, but I also had that worthlessness, I don't know, like wound. And that has really been like the something that I've had to really work on. So I'm definitely relating to a lot of the things that you're saying. But the reason that we had to do all those things, like you probably like external validation, you probably weren't getting validation from your parents. So of course, like we need that from something else.
Yeah.
Like it makes sense why we kind of do these things that then as an adult, we're like, so, I mean, I know I felt like shame for like, I see myself doing these things, talking to myself in such a negative way, but I'm just now learning that like how to be self-compassionate instead of like critical of, okay, those things like protected me at a point, but they're not really serving me now. So shaming them is not going to be the way that they're going to go away. They're just going to get louder and louder. So how do I like view like, oh my gosh, 5-year-old Hannah or 8-year-old Hannah was so smart to think this is the way that she's going to be able to like cope through this, get through this, get to the other side, find a way out of the situation. Like, wow, what a little badass. Like, that's great.
Yes.
And I'm still a badass now. So what's going to be the way that I'm going to get through this new stage of life? But it's really hard and definitely not something that we like naturally know how to do.
No,
like it doesn't just, and I think that's, like we think, oh, why does this person figure it out? Obviously it wasn't natural and easy to write a 600 page Google doc.
No, it was quite a struggle. And I try to say that to people, you know, self-help and healing yourself, it is a struggle. It's not easy. And on the other side, it's a much easier life. It's a much more enjoyable life. But none of this is natural. And in fact, with something like self-criticism in particular, I would criticize myself about criticizing myself, which just made everything much, much worse. But now through writing the book, I've done a lot of research into the science behind why did the tools I was using work so well? Why? A lot of this stuff I just picked up intuitively, thank God. The spirituality part of this is I do think there was something in me that just really wanted to heal. And I feel very connected to that, and that it protected me and that it gave me some of these tools. But the way we're hardwired, just evolution, straight up science, is for negativity. It's the negativity bias, right? And so our brain is wired to scan the horizon for threats. So if you are criticizing yourself, you're worried about the future, congratulations, your brain works. It's doing its job. It's protecting you. So it's not natural. And I hope people feel relieved to know that it's just not a natural thing to treat yourself well.
Yeah. No, I definitely get upset with myself because I feel like I should know better. And it's like, but you actually shouldn't know better. There are tools out there to help you be better, but like knowing how to do that is not something that like Tara figured out and I didn't. Like,
no,
you had to do the hard work.
Yes.
And I also, and you also listening, have the opportunity to do the hard work. I think it's like rewiring that way. But I kind of want to go back to, like I said, the first book was one of my favorites to read, just for you to know, because one, I feel like you did a great job of making me, and I think probably a lot of other people, feel like less alone, kind of with what we just talked about of like, we're not supposed to have it all figured out. Like, and here's how to do it. But then also like you gave me those simple practices to start getting my life together in some way. You kind of mentioned like that catalyst moment of what made you like, be like, okay, I've got to do something because I'm not wanting to like live my life anymore. But can you share kind of like the rituals that you accumulated, like just some of those that helped make your life better? And then I would say like the hundreds of thousands, because I saw that on your Instagram, 200,000 copies of By Yourself.
250 now.
Oh,
I need to upgrade. I need to update the Instagram photo.
250,000 copies of By Yourself, the effing lilies have been sold. That's for people who are listening. That's like, that's huge.
Yeah.
So congratulations for that.
Oh, thank you. It's the most surprising thing to me ever. But also you mentioned feeling less alone with the book. Mm-hmm. And this will sound so cheesy and you're like, is she for real about that? But the only goal I had in writing that book was to make one person feel less alone. Mm. Because I was an executive. I thought this was a hobby. Like I have an offering. I have this whole chunk of mess of thing that I did to heal myself. I wish somebody else had given me a guidebook. Let me be that somebody else to somebody else, you know?
Yeah.
Like that was why I did the whole thing. So just to hear you say that it felt like that to you, that was my only goal. So thank you. You know, it's
You're
very
so
powerful.
Welcome. Can we talk about some of those simple rituals, practices that you implemented for yourself that you then, of course, wrote about in the book that just started making things feel a little bit better without too much effort that sometimes at the beginning feels just exhausting?
Absolutely. You know, that, and that's all of the work I do. It's, here are small practical tools that you don't need to blow up your life to do. Like, you don't need a ton of money to like have your eat, pray, love moment and go to the ashram. I'm like, dude, you could do this today. Do you have 5 minutes? 'Cause I got an idea for you. So the first practice I'd say is journaling, which, you know, I know you have a journal. I know you know the power of journaling. I hated the idea. when it was presented to me, it was a huge eye roll. And what do you mean? This is so cheesy. What are you going to give me Tibetan prayer beads next and like tell me to see a guru? No, thanks. But I was in such a desperate state that I would try anything. And that's really any tool I try to this day. Naturally, I'm deeply cynical. And I just think there's no way something this cheesy is going to work. And then I try it and I'm like, well, I guess there was something to that.
Yeah.
So journaling is an incredible practice for self-healing for so many reasons. You know, one, if you're anything like me, you're overwhelmed sometimes by your emotions. They're the driver. You're the passenger. It becomes very hard to get out of it. And now all of a sudden your brain is ruminating. You're on one obsessive thought loop about how much you suck. Why did this guy do that to me? What did my boss think? You know, I lived my life in overwhelm. And the very first thing that a journaling practice does is it gets you out of your head and onto the page. It naturally builds perspective. It naturally builds self-awareness. And perspective and self-awareness are always a part of what cures us. It's always a part of what makes us feel more sane. So one, it's just a natural perspective builder where you can see what you're going through. And once you can see it, you can make new choices about how to behave. So just the natural perspective is amazing. I always say it's like DMing with your soul, you know, getting these secret little, maybe even flirty messages from your core, from your center, that these things, the places you need to heal, it's all within you. It's just we're not usually listening to ourselves and we know so much more than we think we do. So once you start writing, it just gives that inner DM a place to go. And a place to be seen. And then I would also say with journaling, there's this fancy science term called affect labeling, which is just the act of writing down your emotions is therapeutically beneficial. There's a ton of science behind it. If you, Hannah, were to write, I feel sad, that the act of confessing that way to a place where you don't feel judged just is beneficial, first off. And then second off, if you can really see how you feel, like I used to think I was anxious all the time, for example. And I actually went to a psychiatrist. I was like, I'm feeling so anxious, but my life is really good. So I don't understand why, you know, I have this amazing boyfriend. Well, he's good. He's fine. Actually, we're having a lot of problems, you know? And she was like, tell me more. And what I realized in telling her the story is, he was lying to me a lot. I kind of sort of thought he was a con man, maybe. You know, he said he was a millionaire, but then I needed to loan him $1,200 to tow his car. You know, there were all these like weird little things. And I thought they were making me anxious because I was always on edge. And she said to me, I don't think you're anxious. I think you're furious. Mm. And I was like mind blown. You're right. I'm really angry at being treated this way. And in a journal, you can kind of tease that out. Am I anxious or am I actually furious? And I have a free emotion wheel. It's in GLOW. I just want people to have it. So it's on my website. It's totally free to anybody, or just Google emotion wheel. Use anybody's emotion wheel. But basically, you can look on an emotion wheel and see, am I really anxious or am I furious? Am I really angry or am I hurt? You know?
I think that is something that I've realized. And I think a lot of people, we don't know what we're actually feeling. We're only kind of taught like you can be mad, happy, or sad.
Yeah.
And like there's so much more than that. Or I love how you talk about, which we'll definitely get into glow about, like anxiety. It's kind of been like what we all think everything is.
Yeah.
And I think you're so right with journaling. I don't know if you ever feel this, but I'll like look at the page after I've had a really a dark season or a dark day. And I'm like, whoa, okay. There's a lie here. Let's unpack it. And it helps me be able to really see those negative loops that I'm on, see how much like the self-criticism is like running my life right now.
Yeah.
Be able to like really be like, is any of this actually true? Or is this some like stuff that I'm making up about myself right now? Like,
oh yeah.
I do think journaling really does help bring awareness and perspective to where you actually are. But I guess for people who are like just starting, it's like when you just started, did you have a prompt or did you just start writing how crappy you felt? Like, is that how you start? Usually if you're like at the point of like, I guess I'm going to freaking try journaling, it's probably because you feel crappy. So do you just start writing how crappy you feel?
Yeah. Yeah. I actually did just start. It's called free writing.
Yeah.
Now that I've looked into the science, the science term is expressive writing. And the idea is that if you were to write 3 to 4 times for about 15 minutes each time, just about these harder times you're going through, just describing the situation you're in, there is therapeutic benefit just to narrating your own story. Mm-hmm. And the science behind it is that in confessing in a non-judgmental place, we relieve stress. So we physically relieve cortisol from our bodies. And so life just feels easier because we're less stressed out. The way I see it is that we become the narrators of our own stories. We really get to own our own stories. And back to Nora Ephron, my stepmom of sorts, she was giving a commencement address and she said, above all else, be the heroine of your story, not the victim. And, you know, that was one of these moments where I thought, you know, in a journal, you really get to rewrite. You get to, I say, it gets you an Oprah mind, you know, like not only can you write down your fears and your worries and feel better. My journal was the first place I could start to dream again because I was getting all the gunk out of my head, all the limitations, all the obstacles. And I could start to think, maybe I can be remarkable. I remember that. One day I just wrote, maybe I could be a remarkable person. And it was like, wait a minute, maybe I could be. And, you know, it wasn't a positive affirmation like, I'm going to make $1 million tomorrow. It was something reasonable, maybe. And that maybe was enough optimism to get me to keep going and to keep trying to help myself. And just a quick little tool, because you just mentioned the self-criticism. In a journal, here's a second free, easy tool you could do today. If you write down your negative belief, like I was laid off from my job at Comedy Central, which is a whole other story, whole other book.
And, which we will get to. Yeah.
And I would think, I'm never going to find a job again. I'm never going to find a job again. That was my inner critic. So on a piece of paper, I'll write down 3 columns. Fact, fiction, what else might be true? Mm-hmm. So I'll never find a job again. Now, the reason I would put that in the fiction column is anytime in your mind that you hear absolutes, I'm never, it's always, you know, like we know that absolutes are not true. We're adults. Absolutes are rarely, if ever, true, right? So I just see that word never. And I'm like, girl, you are way overemphasizing, you're being dramatic right now. Like, I don't think that's true. So what's a fact? Okay, a fact, and if I'm in a really bad place, a fact for me might be, it's more likely I'll find a job before the end of time. That that I can get on board with.
We can say that's probably true. Yes.
That's probably true. And to get a little dreamier, I would say something like, what else might be true? Okay, well, if it's more likely I'll find a job before the end of time, maybe I'll even love that job. You know?
Wow, that's big. But
and then, you know, people, it really is a positive affirmation, but I'm trying to come up with a new term for it, like real reality. Because it, you know, it's not about pretending life is some other way and everything's going to be roses. It's about seeing the reality that you're usually not doomed. You know, even in your worst moments, there are still beautiful things happening. Like toxic positivity would be to say, everything's great and it happened for a reason. Like, yay. No way. I wasn't laid off for a reason.
Yay.
I'm like imagining people with little like flags and they're waving them. Yay. And it's like, no, dude, not at all. I really wish that I'd had my income and job. You know, like, I really wish I hadn't been laid off. And now it's up to me to see the rest of my life well, but I do have all these great relationships, friendships, and I'm super resilient, and I'm probably going to get myself out of this. So both things are true. And I think we need practice with fact, fiction, what else might be true, because that's how you deal with the inner critic. It's not by ignoring the inner critic. I call it the frenemy within, you know, like an old camp friend who you wouldn't be friends with today, but you've known each other so long that like sort of feel obliged to keep her in your life, you know? But that's how we deal with the inner critic, is not by saying, oh, I'm so stupid, I should know better than to be criticizing myself, or just getting lost and I'll never have a job again. It's by, on paper, really with a scalpel, figuring out, well, what's actually the truth here? So that's another great tool you can use in a journal.
Yeah, my psychiatrist made me do this exercise similar, where it's like, is it true? Is it absolutely true? And there's like, first I had to ask if it was true. And sometimes I'd say, yes, it is. And he'd be like, but is it absolutely true? And it's like, okay, I cannot say this is absolutely true.
Oh, I love
that. And
then
trying to reframe whatever that negative, same thing. Like if it's like, I'll never get a job again. It's flipping it and being like, I will get a job sometime. Yeah. I don't know exactly when, but like, I will get a job.
Yeah.
And
it
how
brings important. You back. It brings you back to reality instead of being overwhelmed by this negativity. You're like, oh, wait a minute. And it's also kind of funny. Like some, you know,
totally to like, to actually go through what is the cycle loop in your head to actually realize like, oh my gosh, I'm thinking this absolutely crazy thing 42,000 times today.
Yeah, and, exactly.
And like, yeah.
And it is something like 42,000 times a day. This is wild. I just learned this statistic. We have 70,000 thoughts a day. What percent do you think are negative of 70,000?
For me, I need to work on it. I would say 80%.
You're right. It's
I'm right.
80%. It's 80% of that 70,000, which is too many thoughts. Which, we all need some rest. Way too much thinking. 80% are negative, and 95% are thought loops. Just repetitive. Like we're not gaining new information. There's no insight. It's just I suck, I suck, I suck, I suck, I suck. So again, like even getting back to one of the things you first said, it's not natural to feel good about yourself.
Yeah.
Like truly 80% of everything in your brain, and that's how you're programmed, is going to be negative. So to take something like this exercise and to really see like, oh, that's not absolutely true. I'll say something to myself, I'll do that. And then I'll say, and we're back. Like, let me just reset back to reality. Okay. Yeah. Here we are. You know, you want to be playful about it. It's serious work that we need to do, and it can be enjoyable, even when it's hard.
Totally. And we've got to find a way to enjoy it in some way, because it doesn't really end, unfortunately. And that kind of goes, it is unfortunate. I'm like, why can I not just read like, can there be a number of books you read, a number of therapy sessions you go to that it's like, okay,
we're good.
Now we're good. But that kind of gets me to this new book, Glow in the Effing Dark, because, you know, I'm assuming at this time, Buy Yourself the Effing Lilies, like everyone's, you know, it's been this huge success. People are really learning, growing from it. You've obviously like learned and grown so much. You're actually like enjoying your life now, found ways to actually live it. And you've already like done so much to heal for yourself. Can you talk about like how, like after you got laid off from your job at Comedy Central, what did you discover about like the next phase of your healing journey and how that became this new book?
Yeah. And I'll preface it with, I was so annoyed that I had more healing to do. I was laid off like unceremoniously from my job. It's like, cool, you've been here 12 years. Bye. Like, see you. Love you so much. I'm like, cool. Okay. Bye. But what I hadn't realized was that the job was a stand-in for my status. My whole identity was tied to this job. And externally too, people would introduce me, Tara Schuster, Comedy Central, like it was my married last name.
Yeah. And you hadn't realized this in your first part of your healing. Like that was not something that had been like opened in your mind yet.
Yeah. I mean, I knew that external validation was a big driver, but it wasn't until the job was taken away that I really saw, whoa, you know, I am my job. My job was one of the things that mattered the most to me. And now it's gone. And what I also didn't realize was that the job was sort of a levee keeping my darkest traumas at bay. Because even though I had done all this work, my belief was, and I don't know if you relate to this, but at that time, my belief was, well, the really bad things that happened so young that you can't really heal it. Like if it's bedrock, you know, I really had this belief, like, sure, maybe I can feel a little better, but I don't think it can be healed. So I don't
like I'm always going to be this way. I'm always going to be like a little wounded here. So I've just got to like do these rituals, find these things to make it a little bit better, but it's not going to actually like healing's not in the cards for me. Feeling better maybe. Yes.
So even with a successful self-help book that was helping people, I still believed that there was a fundamental wound that I would never be able to get over. And that was being lovable. I felt very unlovable, you know, at the end of the day. And so when I lost this job, that unlovable trauma was like, hey, I'm here now and I'm going to live my best life ever, which means you're going to have no life. And it was just awful. It was overwhelming. It was also the pandemic. I was estranged from both of my parents, no partner, no family, like just in a one-bedroom apartment in Los Angeles with me and my thoughts. It was really unpleasant.
Very tough position to be in, for sure, for everyone. But like cards stacked against Tara were not like the ideal deck.
It was unfun, you know, not the ideal childhood. It was an unfun situation.
Yeah.
And that's when I realized I need to figure out who I am when everything is lost, when I lose the job, when I'm not really anybody's daughter right now, when I don't have income, when I don't have status, when I'm not a fancy person, who remains? And, you know, to me, it sounds so ridiculous that the subtitle to my book is, it's something like Rituals to Heal Your Soul. I'm like, who would say that? Like, what a lame, like, what do you mean heal your soul? But honestly, that's the journey I went on, was to get right with my soul. And I really feel now like I came such a far way on that journey, and enough so that I can share it with people. But, you know, at the time, I felt like I was in a good enough plateau. Like,
yes, I wanted to talk about the good enough plateau. Yeah. I feel like that's ooh, where we, a lot of us can find ourselves.
Yeah. You know, and it was like leagues and leagues away from where I began, you know? So I don't even diss the Good Enough Plateau. The Good Enough Plateau was like, thank God that I've like thrown my body on the good enough, the shores of the Good Enough Plateau. And, you know, as I was saying, it wasn't quite the right job. I knew that. I always knew that. I always knew I actually wanted to be a writer. And I always knew that I wanted to live my life with more freedom, not so much in a 9-to-5, but this was good enough. And it wasn't until the layoff where I was like squarely kicked off the Good Enough Plateau that I decided, well, what would be more, you know? And I felt embarrassed, like, oh, I want more out of life. Who am I? Like, how dare I? But I wanted more. I wanted a more aliveness, more joy, more fun. And so that's a big part of this book too, is I think there's a bigger life available to all of us if we want it. And bigger doesn't mean better. It just means deeper, more vibrant, more aligned.
Totally. Yeah, I feel like when you come from shitty beginnings, anything that's a little bit better, you feel like, oh, I should be grateful for this.
Yeah.
Like, and I think that's where, like, I mean, I think gratitude's so, I do think gratitude's so great, but sometimes I think it can stop some of us for thinking that we are even deserving for asking for more. But I think that also goes back to that. Okay. We actually haven't healed the wound that thinks that we're not worthy to ask for some more. So for people listening that are like, oh my gosh, like, am I in the good enough plateau? Like, what does a good enough life look like versus a life that you could feel like, maybe this is asking a little bit too much of life, but actually a life of more? Like, what do you feel like those two look like against each other? What are people missing out on?
I love that question, and I've never been asked it before. And I think it's so essential.
Yeah.
The way I can best describe it is on the good enough plateau, you know, I had good enough sort of boyfriends in and out. Like, I was dating and that was great. And, you know, I kind of had some dreams and that was fine. But I also had this, what I thought was anxiety running under everything. And the best way to describe it was I really felt like under my skin, like in my blood was like itchy. There's just this boiling itch that I felt all of the time. And I could tune in and out of it. You know, like I'd be, you know, doing something else and it'd be really fun and I wouldn't feel it. But the moment I relaxed or was quiet, the itch would be there. Mm-hmm. And so to me, that's when I know I'm in a good enough plateau, is something just feels off. And I might not know exactly what it is, but I know something is off. Whereas now, where I don't think I'm on any kind of plateau, I feel like I'm flying in the universe, in the sky, in the stars, like that. I feel very free and really free from a lot of the emotional trauma, which, by the way, if anyone thinks, oh, I can't heal that, I got news for you. That ain't the case. I'm the biggest cynic, the biggest. And I was a self-help writer and I was still cynical. Now I know you really can heal your root issues, your core issues, and you can heal your relationship to those issues. But, and on the other side of that, how the best word I can use is I feel aligned. So that itchiness now just feels like, yes, 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 yes. Like, yes, this is the right. Even talking to you, for example, is like a full body yes. Like this feels right. I'm getting to learn about you. Like even just looking at you, I'm like, oh, what a special moment. Those are the kinds of thoughts I have when I'm off the good enough plateau, as opposed to, does she like me? Does she think this interview is going well? What? I'm a lot less, I'm way more in the moment and a lot less judgmental or thinking about how things are going.
I relate to this so much because I have been doing, I'm like, I did therapy COVID was hard for me, and I feel like I healed or got better. I'll say I got better. And then this past, I would say 3-4 months, I've really started to heal.
Amazing.
And it looks different. It's a different process. And I'm so thankful for getting better.
Yeah.
And I think like those practices and the information that was given and even just starting that journey, like you've got to start. And when you're like, when everything feels really, really bad, like you just got to start, and feeling better feels like the best gift in the world.
Yes.
And then, like you said, like you'll start to realize, oh, like, this is great, but I love how you talk about the itchy feeling, because this is what I've also talked about, that I get like this itch, and there's just this unrest under it. But you're like, oh my gosh, why am I feeling this? Because I should be feeling like great because everything's so much better.
Yes.
And then, but I loved how in the book you talk about how when you decided to go on this like journey of healing your soul, you were scared.
Yes.
Very. Because it's like you've already done, like the first work was hard.
Yeah.
But this like extra, like this layer under the layer can feel so scary, because there's a reason why we've pushed it down so far to begin with. Like there was a reason.
Yes.
And I have definitely felt myself in that. I'd have a journal doc with my therapist where she'll look at and kind of reflect after therapy with it. And I was just like, it's so scary, because I know it's going to be a lot of work. And my biggest fear, we had to get down to like, what is that actual fear for me? I'm interested what your actual fear was. My biggest fear was that I would end up in a mental hospital. That's what I would say, because I was scared that if I really got down to it, it would break me. And I've done a good job of, even when things were crappy, it was like, I could keep it good enough. I could stay good enough. And I was scared if I actually went down to that layer, that good enough would be gone.
Yeah.
And what was I going to be left with? And where was I going to go back to? And it was so cool, her like listening to that. And we talked about it in the next session. And she was like, let's think of the worst. You're saying the worst case would be that you would end up in a mental hospital. She's like, well, great. You know, you've been saying your phone and getting back to people stress you out. You won't have your phone. And you're going to go and you're going to be able to relax. And then guess what? You're going to have me. You're going to have Adam. You're going to have people in your life that are going to be there for you after, and that are going to help you. And then we're going to continue working on all this. So we already can go to the worst case scenario, and you're still going to be okay. So we're still going to have to do this work anyway.
Exactly.
So that, it was just like, okay, like I can do, and I will be able to survive even the worst thing that could happen of all this.
Yes.
And because I have people around me that are going to be supporting me. So that was my biggest fear. And knock on wood, I haven't ended up in a mental hospital yet. But even so, I'm like, it could be a nice break. What was your big fear of doing this like extra layer of work, and like the biggest work, I think, of our life?
And I just want to thank you for sharing that. That really touched me, because we don't really ever talk about stuff like this, you know, much less what's your biggest fear around it. Mm-hmm. And so I just personally want to thank you, because that made me feel a lot less alone, because I too, what I thought was going to happen was that my life was good enough. If I untethered myself at all, it was going to overwhelm me, be awful. I would go crazy. And then I would be throwing away this whole thing that was pretty good that I had worked like hell to achieve. So what was the point? Also, would endless rehashing of the past really mean anything? Especially because I fundamentally believed I couldn't heal. So it was like, oh, overwhelm yourself, make your life miserable, blow up the stability to what? Maybe not be able to heal ever. But what I realized right around that time was that the worst things that had happened to me had already happened to me, and I was surviving. I had been through all those things already. And I was living. And it wasn't like, I think we get caught in a false sort of story about this, which is if we don't deal with these things, then we're safe. But the truth is, these things are dealing with us presently. It's not like, oh, because I ignored them, they're not awake, alive, present, having me act in ways that I'm not in control of. That's what's happening. And so the truth actually wasn't that scary. The truth was, oh, I'm already living with these things. They're already overwhelming me. Now I just get to reclaim my agency. Now I just get to see how strong I actually am, because I've already been dealing with them this whole friggin' time. I've been dealing with them.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you also for sharing that, because I feel like that it's hard because we can't even share it with ourselves first, because that's the reason we haven't done it. Yeah. And to be able to be like, I'm proud of us for being able to not be like, have understood that fear for ourselves, but also can like speak it, because then it doesn't give it as much ownership and like the driver's seat. Kind of like you said, like if you don't deal with it, it's going to be dealing with you every day. And we've just found good ways again to cope with it.
Right.
But like, I would actually prefer to deal with it. And I think that also kind of goes back to what you learned about anxiety and why we like we use anxiety as like the, I loved the like scarlet letter thing that you had going on with like, a lot of us find ourselves wearing the scarlet letter A of anxiety. I thought that was so like, I definitely resonated with that of like, it's just something that I deal with, and it's something that is me. Like I am anxiety.
Yes.
And I think there are a lot of people who also have that feeling. And you kind of talk about anxiety is kind of like our blanket statement, I feel like, especially now, because it's like we've decided that it's who we are, but there's actually like all these emotions under that, and it's because we don't actually know how to feel. What feelings for you did you realize that you didn't know how to feel, and how did you learn how to feel them and, you know, finally take off that scarlet letter off your chest?
Yeah, it's, you know, this is one of the things I'm definitely the most passionate about, and also, you know, want to be very like understanding. I've been diagnosed. You know, if you were to look at my insurance bills, I'm diagnosed
same with everything,
right? Diagnosed anxiety, diagnosed depression. And those two labels really helped me initially because I was like, oh my God, I'm not crazy. Like, these are the things that I'm dealing with. Wow. Now I can do something about them. They're named. Now I can do something about them. And at a certain point, when we start hearing ourselves say things like, well, I'm just a depressed person. I was born anxious. I've been anxious since I was a little kid. That I'm anxious. We really have to be careful because, you know, back to that absolute thing. Are you absolutely anxious all of the time, and now that's just your being? Or do you experience moments of anxiety, and are those even anxiety?
And when
we say I'm an anxious person, basically the rest of that sentence is, and I don't have any agency. I'm just anxious.
And I don't have any other feel, like every feeling is anxiety.
Yeah, the only, I'm a wash of anxiety. And that becomes very dangerous because then it's really hard to do anything about it if you're just a wash of anxiety.
Yeah.
So I really feel like women in particular, the scarlet letter of A for anxiety, it's easy to dismiss a woman if she's just anxious. You know, she's just anxious. Oh, and we dismiss ourselves. I'm just anxious. It's no big deal. I'm just anxious. And it's like, okay, well, are you anxious, or do you have some real rooted fears that anyone would have in this world today that need to be dealt with? But we don't need to reduce ourselves to the word anxious, mostly because it's such a dismissive term. Like, it may not have begun that way, but we all have heard, oh, she's just anxious. Oh, you're just anxious, sweetheart. Don't worry about it. And so what I'm saying is, let's get under the anxiety.
I have so many questions for you, but people will have to like get this book, and you really kind of go into all these places where we could heal more, or these wounds that you've had that I feel like a lot of us had, and how you've learned to glow through that. But just in general, what does it mean to glow? Do we all have that inside of us? What is that? And what do you hope people get from this book?
Yeah. Oh, what a great question to end on. It's so, you know, in the beginning of the book, I write a lot about this layoff, right? Layoff, the trauma has come flooding back. I'm fully having a dissociative episode for days. A dissociative episode, the way I describe it is like the unwanted love child of a panic attack and a nightmare. It feels.
Yeah, I'm like, don't want that.
Yeah, right. And I, you know, for people who haven't felt it, good. I'm so glad. For those of you who have, I'm really sorry, because it feels awful. And basically what your body and mind are doing are they're disconnecting from reality in order to protect you. So again, it's like a protective mechanism. But I decided, okay, I'm not going to sit here in LA and call my therapist and deal with this. I am just going to get another job. And the most important thing going on was the 2020 election. If you remember, it was super fun. Great time for everybody. Great time. No stress.
Yeah.
Amazing times. And I was like, okay, that's the most important thing. I need the most important job. What can I do? Googled, what can I do to help in the 2020 election? Google said, you can help register voters in Arizona. I grabbed my Vitamix, my like smoothie blender, a bag of books, threw them in my Prius of doom, and hit the road. I was like, I'm out of here. Peace out, LA. And I'm on this road. I'm going like 85, 90, 95. And if you know me, I should not be speeding. Like, that's not my level of driving. And I'm just trying to make it to Arizona. And it's feeling less and less safe. Like, I actually don't feel safe. And I realize I have to pull over. I cannot keep overwhelming my way through life. I actually have to pull over. This is no longer an option. And because I had done such a super good job planning this move, it was fully nighttime. It was like very dark out. And I was on Highway 40 in the Mojave Desert, where the stars just glow. I mean, I'm sitting, you know, I hadn't even noticed the stars until I pulled over. And I looked up and I'm like, oh my God, this is like a star field. And as I looked up at the stars, I just wondered, can I do that? You know, can I glow? When things are really dark, because this was, you know, a dark night, but metaphorically a dark night. And I was in a dark night of the soul, you know? And the reason I asked myself that was because I knew we are made of stardust, not in a Hallmark card, let me crochet this on a pillow kind of way, though I'd buy that pillow, by the way. Not in that kind of way, but in a Carl Sagan science, the carbon in your muscles, the iron in your blood come from stars. At your core, you are made of stardust. And I just thought, well, what if I trusted my stardust? I can't trust myself.
Because stars are really cool.
Stars are the coolest. Like, nobody ever backtalks the stars and says like, oh, the stars didn't finish their to-do list. They suck. Yeah. Why are the stars still dating? Shouldn't they be married? Yeah, nobody's saying that, because we all agree stars are dope, right?
Yeah.
And so if that's in me already, how do I unlock that? How do I let that out? How do I let out that glow? And that's what I want everybody to know. As down on yourself as you are, as much as you don't trust yourself, and so many of us feel completely disconnected from our gut or what we want, guess what? You have stardust in yourself, an actual miracle. You are an actual miracle scientifically. And so how do we let that shine? And that's the whole, that's everything I'm doing now, is how do we unlock that essential self that doesn't rely on status, income, any of those external markers, but is completely with like, well, what's really inside of you? And can you bring that out? Because we need one another to glow. In this moment in particular, we need everybody's light, right? This is an all hands on deck situation. And so I just really hope that people can recognize they've got that in them. And now it's not a matter of going to the ashram. It's not a matter of blowing up your life. It's a matter of healing what needs to be healed so that that glow can naturally just come out.
Yeah, I totally agree. I started thinking about, you know, I lived in LA and like those same stars are there. But there's
great
just
point.
Like smog and shit that's in the air that hasn't, you know, nobody really cares about.
Nobody
cared about enough for us to really be able to uncover what's behind. So like that's kind of what we have to do in our own lives. It's like, I know for me, there's definitely been some smog and some crap in the air that I've just allowed to be there in my life. And it's just like, okay, what are you going to do to like clean up your own environment, your own galaxy? Because like those same stars that you're being able to see in your life, Tara, like you listening have that too. Like it's not that she has something more than, you do. Like you shine just as bright. We just got to like clean some stuff up. And in your book, and I think you give a lot of like practices for how do we like slowly focus back in, clean up, get a better visual of the like sparkle glow in our life. And I'm definitely on that journey too. Anything like worth doing is hard. Yeah. And I feel like this book and what you're doing and how you're showing up, Tara, is helping people at least know that they can do it. So just thank you so much. I enjoyed this conversation so, so much. I am so thankful for you and how you've helped me. And I know you helped so many other people. And this was awesome.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for being so honest. This is like you're a bright star on that. Like I feel less alone just hearing you talk about your story. So thank you.
Thanks. I appreciate that. Thank you guys so much for listening to the episode. Better Tomorrow is produced by me, Hannah Brown, and Legos Creative. Our show is recorded, engineered, and edited by the Legos Creative team. Remember to follow Better Tomorrow wherever you get your podcast so you don't miss the next episode. And don't forget to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It really helps and shows your support. You can follow me on socials at Hannah Brown, and you can stay updated on all things Better Tomorrow on our Instagram at Better Tomorrow and our TikTok Better Tomorrow Podcast.